This is the Young Farmer Podcast. I'm Lindsay Lushershute. Today, I'm speaking with Mike Nolan, a farmer at Mountain Roots Produce and chapter leader at the Four Corners Farmers and Ranchers Coalition that's based near Mancos, Colorado. Mike is already growing in a dry climate, but this year has been especially tough. He explains the challenges brought by drought and severe weather and how he is coping with it all. He also tells us how MicroEquip, an idea he had over some beers, made it all the way to the Senate version of the Farm Bill.
Hi, I'm Julia Asherman, farmer at Rag and Frass Farm in Jeffersonville, Georgia, and a leader of the Middle Georgia Young Farmers Coalition. I'm a member of the National Young Farmers Coalition because it's so important for young farmers to work together to create change. For $35 a year, you can join too. In addition to being part of a bright and just future for agriculture in the United States, you'll also get discounts like 40% off Filson and 25% off farm-to-feed socks. To join, go to youngfarmers.org.
You know, you guys had that, at your place, you had that massive hailstorm rip through.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, season. I feel like we've had like kind of like one of those events or something like that, like every 10 to 14 days where it's like,
oh,
we're like, really? Like it's either hail or bug infestations or water issues or smoke or fire or something.
You've had it all. So can you just, you know, even now when I talk about the water situation, particularly to really new farmers where you are, who are East Coast farmers, it's just so different. I mean, you've farmed on this side of the country for a while, so you can understand the contrast. Could you just very briefly describe how your farm gets water?
Yeah, definitely. Basically, our water rights go back to the late 1800s. They're some of the oldest in the state. So a lot of the farms and ranches here have adjudicated water rights. So they're water rights that kind of stay with the ground. Like ours come off river. So we have river water rights. And then we also have storage water rights. So we have storage water out of our lake, which serves the Mancos Valley. And that deeds us an acre foot of water per acre on an annual basis. And then we have...
And that's not water that you have on your farm. That's in the reservoir.
Yeah, that's in a reservoir. And that reservoir also serves Mancos Rural Water, which is our domestic water. It serves the town of Mancos, and it also serves Mesa Verde National Park. So, and that reservoir is small compared to a lot of places. It's only 10,000 acre feet when it gets full. And right now, after this summer, I think it's sitting at about 1,400 acre feet going into the winter with the two municipalities or municipal water, Mancos and Mesa Verde, will be continuously using it all winter.
Okay, so a little over 10% full. How does that compare with a normal August? Like, where should the reservoir be at this time of year?
You know, normally the reservoir would be 30 to 40% full, possibly higher. The tricky part this year, Lindsay, was that in a normal year, we get to run off our adjudicated water, our priority water. And in the past 5 years on this place, we can run off river water until about, you know, 4th of July, sometimes early August. And this year, we didn't get a single day of river water. And then our storage water was limited to 60% of our total allotment. So this is really abnormal. And the hardest part about it, honestly, was we didn't get any precipitation all winter, so the ground was so dry. So even hay guys around here, they could throw 2 to 3 inches of water in 24 hours on hay ground, and it would just drop right into the water table. Like, you'd come back 7 days later, and it'd be bone dry.
If you have senior rights, then there's a lot of other people who clearly didn't get water either.
Yeah, some folks still have river water. So here's kind of an interesting thing. It's the town of Mancos is priority 3, but the priority is sitting at 2 right now. So the town of Mancos is actually using their storage water, and there's 2 irrigators in the valley that are priority 1 and 2 that are using water right now to irrigate hay. So the town has actually fallen out of priority, which rarely happens.
The town has fallen out of priority for its river water.
Yeah. So the town usually is able to pull off the Mancos River for their domestic water use. But right now they're just pulling off the lake.
And so they're further depleting the reservoir.
Yeah. And I don't totally know what their usage is. It's a small town, so I can't imagine more than an acre foot or two. But yeah, they're using their lake water. Everyone's on storage water right now. And it's scary out there.
Yeah. So you have received 60% of your total allotment this season for storage mm-hmm. water. How is that impacting the farm?
So this winter, my farm partner and girlfriend, Mindy Perkovich, and I kind of sat down and we knew it was going to be tight. So we wanted to, you know, we knew we needed to do the CSA crops and we can kick that on domestic water. Then we kind of had tiers of like, okay, storage beet, potatoes, winter squash, you know. Last year we did about 7 acres of production. This year I think we did about 1.7, 2 acres of production. So we're super limited. Our water came on about 4 weeks later than it should. And we've been out of water for, I think, 2.5 weeks now. And we've had like barely any rain. We've been running off our Mancos rural water just to tease things along. And we've just taken crops that we would like to finish out, like the cabbage and the beans, and we've either just mowed them and decked them or picked them early. We could afford to water it with rural water.
That's like from the town?
It's our domestic water for the valley. So, and you know, we don't like to use too much of that stuff because the pH is a little bit off. It's a little bit higher in salt. It's chlorinated.
It's treated water.
It's treated water. And I hate using treated water for vegetable production personally.
And it's expensive, I imagine.
Oh, yeah. You know, we budgeted about $1,000 for the last 6 weeks of the season to be able to tide us through.
Wow. So what is next for you guys for next season? Doesn't seem like it's expected to get much better next year, and the reservoirs are lower than in previous seasons. What are you thinking about for the 2019 season?
We're thinking a lot of stuff, Lindsay. It's, you know, with all the work we've done in NYFC, you know, we always talk about resiliency, right? Resiliency and drought. And what I've realized this year is that I can totally figure out how to be resilient with my markets and my crop production. What I'm having a hard time with is being resilient in relationships and with my mental health. And I don't think that Mindy and I could do this again next year. I think it would crush us. So if things don't get better, we're just going to get jobs for a year. We'll have some water. We'll be able to cover crop things, pray for some rain. In the meantime, financially, we're okay. Like, we'd have enough to start up again next year. But if we don't farm, we won't have enough to do it again in 2020. We're trying to be really pragmatic about it and not take it too close to heart or personally if we can't farm next year. Because fighting it is not going to... You can't fight this. In order for us to be looking good next year, and these are things I think folks out of the Mountain West don't totally understand about water, is that, you know, we need some good fall rains to wet the mountains so that the snow, and then we need a good snowpack, and then we need a slow melt. And the reason why we want the mountains to go in wet is that if the mountains go in dry, which is what happened last year, the little bit of snow there, you know, for every 10 inches of moisture up there, you can lose 40 to 60% of it to the ground. And we want that to run into the rivers. So we need to kind of have like a very normal fall, winter, spring in order to kind of pull ourselves out of this.
If there are those conditions possibly in the fall, then you and Mindy might consider making a go of it for 2019.
The plan will be to farm next year until we really get those clear signals that it's not a good idea, basically. Every year is a gamble. But, you know, I have this silly analogy when it comes to this water stuff that helps me understand it, is that it's all this stuff is kind of like a GPA. So it's like you do all this, it's good, 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 and then you have one year or one bad grade, and it totally screws you up, and then it can take years to get back to that place that you were prior. And that's kind of where we're at now, is that one winter is not going to save us. We probably will have a limited year next year. It's going to take a couple good winters and some good summer rains to pull us out of this.
And what are you hearing from folks who give technical support and are making projections on the weather?
You know, they're all spring, they're like, this is going to be one of the best monsoon years on record. And
really?
We've gotten about an inch of moisture or less than that all summer. And so they're predicting for a wet fall, but I honestly have no idea like what to expect.
Right.
We're just grateful that it's cooled off a little bit, because the other thing is that our nighttime and daytime temperatures are 5 to 10 degrees above average for most of the summer as well. It was a very bizarre summer here. But, you know, some of my 80-year-old neighbors are like, they've never seen this before. So we have some CSA members that do, you know, there's a lot of folks that work for the Fed around here, federal government, whether it's BLM, Forest Service.
On federal lands.
National parks. I mean, they employ so many people in our region because we're surrounded by every form of public lands. So there's lots of scientists and biologists, and we have a woman that's a CSA member, and she does lizard studies. And she was telling us that she's seeing pine, pinon, and juniper trees that are 80 to 90 years old just completely dying on some of her plots that she's researching.
Because of the weather, because of lack of rainfall.
2018 is one for the books, is the most polite way I can say it.
And then on top of that, there was the 416 fire.
Mm-hmm.
Is that the one that has impacted you as well? I know there have been quite a few in the region.
The big impact of the fires is that it hit the economy super hard. Everybody's numbers were down. I mean, wholesale numbers were down across the board for farmers. People weren't eating out as much. Tourism kind of dropped off. Hannah and Daniel, who are NYFC members, they're about 45 minutes away from us. They were saying that there was a 4 or 5 week period where their wholesale numbers were down about 60% or more. Locals were leaving town, so they weren't buying at the local restaurants, and then tourists weren't coming. And it was just this really weird, like, one restaurant we sell to was closed for 3 weeks because of the fire, because they couldn't access it. They pulled them out of there on opening night. So we lost that account for about 3-4 weeks. And then you throw smoke in on top of that, and, you know, that kind of messes with the plants. Like, it was causing all of our head lettuce successions to bolt, because I think it was messing with their daylight requirements. We would have multiple times where our visibility was like a mile and a half, 2 miles, and the sun was red, kind of like the eclipse last summer. And we would plant these head lettuce successions, and they would just barely grow and then bolt. And it was usually a couple days after we'd have one of those kind of smoke events. So, yeah, that's another crazy thing about the fires. But the economy hit was the really big one. And I will give props to everyone, like, being really resilient about it, and also to our elected officials on both sides of the aisle that showed up. I mean, we had our congressional rep, both senators, governor, everyone in the state house, state senate, county commissioners, everyone really pushing for people to like come back to our area, because we're such a tourist economy.
Just by promoting it and saying,
yeah,
it's still safe, you should come, it's beautiful.
Yeah, we're still open for business.
I mean, I guess that sort of brings me to another question. How does policy relate to any of this? And what do you want elected officials to do to help farmers in your region?
That having direct assistance payments is, I think, what they really need. There's so many cattle producers, hay producers, you know, producers that are just on the verge of bankruptcy, that the last thing they need is a loan.
And you're talking about like an emergency loan offered by Farm Service Agency?
Yeah. And those, you know, I appreciate those, and I think they work for some people. But we are down here with our state representative, Mark Catlin, and that's what all, I mean, these are guys and girls that do not want to ask the government for everything. And they were like, we need something. Otherwise, you know, our centennial farms are going to be filing for bankruptcy, and we're done. And there's no reason for the next generation to come in if it's not economically viable in any way, shape, or form.
I don't disagree with you at all, but I wonder, what is the strategy to keep those farms viable if these conditions continue? Like, I think they do need, you know, more than a loan, potentially.
Right.
But, like, for how, I mean, no one knows for how long. The what we're seeing with global warming is only going to make these conditions potentially even worse than they are now. So what are people talking about just like the future of agriculture in the region? Like, is there a path forward?
Yeah. So I think that's a great question. I don't think it's smart for anybody to prop up types of agriculture that are long-term unsustainable, stewardship wise, but also economically. I think a couple steps would be to like prop things up now and get it so, you know, these families aren't dipping into all their savings and their kids are going to be left with nothing. Just prop them up for a minute so we can all sit down and figure it out. There are a lot of families in this region who are coming to, I'm on the Mancos Conservation District board as well. And we have multi-generational hay families and cattle families that are coming to our offices being like, what can we do that's different? Like, what crops can we grow that are more profitable? What's up with all this market gardening stuff? What's up with this row crop vegetable stuff? Like, what can we change to be more economically versatile and resilient?
And what are they growing right now?
I mean, in this valley, like hay and cattle, there's no real crop production in Mancos per se.
So one of the things, Mike, that I've heard you talk about that I appreciate is this need for young farmers to really stand with multi-generational farmers, some farmers who are doing things very differently at a much different scale. You describe culturally like the importance of having this farm community intact. Can you just speak to that for a minute? Like, why do you think it's so important to have these larger farms in your region?
Farmers make up, you know, 2% or less of the population. And whether somebody's raising commodities or, you know, these hay guys are raising hundreds of acres of hay, you know, and hundreds of heads of cattle, and I'm over here doing an acre or two potatoes, like, we're all in the same boat. We're all in that small number of people. So inadvertently creating divisions, being like, we're really different and better or worse than, or any of those kind of things, I don't think that's helpful. Because you sit down with a lot of these farmers or ranchers and, you know, I understand there's a unique set of struggles that NYFC is addressing really well when it comes to young and beginning farmers and ranchers. But they're not too dissimilar to some of the things that these farmers or older farmers and ranchers have gone through and also are kind of struggling with too. I mean, it's still hard to make a living. Whether you're starting out or 3, 4, 5 generations in, it can be really challenging. You know, there's just such a wealth of knowledge there. And so like that kind of cohabitation is really important to me.
Yeah, we've definitely had a similar experience in New York, just really needing those farmers to be there for so many reasons, because they're the reason we have a tractor dealership and a market, you know, and availability of, you know, mechanics. And even if we're doing things totally differently, you know, and even if they think we're crazy on some level, you know, there's still like this mutual respect and understanding about the life we live and the hours we work and the seasonality and the risk and that sort of thing that is just like so, so vital for farmers to do well. I think it's just too hard to be out there by yourself.
It's pretty awesome to have those kind of connections.
So, you know, I just, on the federal level, I think people are looking at conservation programs. Do you think conservation programs can help in a moment like this?
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't have any ground in CRP. And there's a lot of ground in our region that's in those conservation programs. And on a year like this, that ground has become really vital. That a lot of folks up in the Dove Creek area and some of these other places in Montezuma County and Dolores County, the state has allowed them to graze their CRP ground, which has been literally a lifesaver for some of their herds.
So you guys in the Southwest are really feeling the brunt of climate change. And I think people are, it seems like with rising temperatures and extended drought, folks are more comfortable pointing to, like,
yeah,
you know, your farm and saying, oh yeah, that's climate change. So do you feel, how do you feel about the government's response on climate, and to what extent do you feel like there should be greater action taken on it? Or do you feel like it's just so slow moving, it's not really going to make a difference?
That's a loaded question, Lindsay.
It's like, if anyone should be complaining, it's you. And you know, like, you've got a pretty strong case to make that climate is having a major impact on your farm, on the local economy, on food security. I feel frustrated about some events that I associate with climate change in New York, but mm-hmm. we're not having to cut our production by more than half. Do you feel like we should be taking more action on climate? Do you feel like the farmers in your region are feeling more passionate about climate issues as well?
To be totally frank, on a federal level, with the Paris Accords and all these other things, I honestly don't know what the feds can do. The Western Slope, for the most part, is pretty conservative. You know, folks don't want government help for the most part. And what I see is that that's changing a little bit. So people want pipelines put in, they want dams and storage upgraded. But what I see is people aren't really on the ground talking about climate change. What they're talking about is that water is scarce, water is rare, and we need to adapt our farming models and we need to do all this kind of stuff. So it's kind of funny, like, we don't actually have the climate change conversation around here all that much. So I don't know how much whatever the feds are going to do is really going to change that. But there's a lot of people, the majority of folks around here, understand that something is changing, and that if we don't start doing things differently, there won't be agriculture to pass down to the next generation.
But when they're thinking doing things differently, that's we need to farm differently, we need to manage water differently. It's not we need to stop emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Yeah, exactly.
And I guess it's like we have to bring these communities together at some point, right? Because you guys are feeling that you're in it, right? You have the stories to tell that I think can really move people to take action, broader action on climate change. Obviously, taking care of this season and next season and keeping a family in business needs to be priority one. But clearly, to achieve climate mitigation, to lessen the long-term impacts for 100 years from now, we all sort of, have to have that recognition of how the United States and globally were impacting this situation.
Yeah, I totally agree. Mindy and I were having a conversation about this maybe yesterday, the day before. You know, a lot of the old timers that we know, like, they just don't believe in climate change. And I said, well, what I've kind of realized is that when you tell somebody who's in their 60s or 70s that climate change is going on, I don't know if it's not that they don't believe it, but I think their perspective is that they've been farming for 60 years. Every year is completely different. They see what they can think is climate changing all the time. So telling them, like, we need to do something, they're like, what are you talking about? Like, so we've kind of realized that kind of stuff. And I think that's, like, you know, a lot of the other, like, the things you're talking about, I agree with. And I think for me, doing what we can here when it comes to management practices and water efficiency, I think that's really huge.
When President Trump withdrew the U.S. from the Paris Accord, was there any reaction from the farm community?
No.
No. Yeah.
Not really. But also, you know, we live in the Wild West. Like, you know, I grew up in California. And living here now, the political landscape is, I find it super intriguing. It's like you could throw yourself into a ditch in the middle of winter and anybody's going to come by and pull you out. Like, people get along really well here. And, but, you know, you just don't talk politics.
It's like we have to maintain these strong and positive relationships that are really driven by being neighbors and being fellow farmers and community members, but also figure out some way to recognize and take action on these global issues because they are also impacting us locally too.
I think the other thing, you know, with doing all the advocacy with NYFC and Rocky Mountain Farmers Union and the Conservation District and all this kind of stuff is there are people in our region doing that thing you're talking about. And I've just realized my role is to not do that. I'm going to sit on my four-wheeler on the fence line and talk to my neighbor about, you know, whatever, you know, about the fox that's eating chickens and, like, what's wrong with this trap and all this kind of stuff. And that's kind of my end.
Yeah, I mean, it's all got to sort of start at the fence line anyways, right? It has to be, like, personal trust and communication.
Yeah.
So, Mike, last thing, I just wanted to congratulate you on Micro Equip and getting that into the Senate version of the Farm Bill. And I wanted to ask you if you could describe sort of the process of making that happen.
Yeah, thanks. You know, it's funny. So Alex Funk, who used to be the Western Policy Director. So we were at Convergence 2 years ago in San Diego.
And I'll say Convergence is National Young Farmers Coalition's gathering of chapter leaders from all across the country. And Mike is the chapter leader of Four Corners.
Basically, we were sitting around one evening after everything, having some beers. And what I realized about this, it's very hard to get anything new into the Farm Bill. And so if you do want to make changes or want something new, to me, the smartest way to go about it is take an existing program and make an adjustment. And part of the inspiration was what you did and NYFC did in its early days with the microloan.
Microloans, sure.
Yeah, so you were taking something that's there, and you're like, well, let's just tweak it and see if we can get more people in the door and more people accessing. And so that was kind of the idea for MicroEquip. There's lots of programs that small-scale growers can access, but there's certain aspects of it that's really challenging. But the hope is to change the EQIP program a little bit so we just have more young beginning and small scale growers walking through the door of NRCS offices. That alone to me is super beneficial because if we don't have that generation of folks coming through the door, what's the point of those offices being there in 20 years?
And it's like the identifiable product for, I think, a lot of young farmers. The microloan has been like, they know, oh yeah, Farm Service Agency through USDA, they have those microloans. I should go check that out. Now that so many new farmers have gotten microloans, it's like, it seems like a place to start for a lot of people, which is great. So, and MicroEquip, so Environmental Quality Incentives Program, which is how we've used it on our farm, for instance, to do high tunnels, build greenhouses for season extension. Was there a project on your farm that you sort of had in mind when you were thinking about this concept?
I had been looking at the cover crop payments. We do a lot of cover cropping here, and the payments didn't make sense for me to access them, both for my agent to deal with the paperwork and also for me to make the trip over to Cortez to kind of deal with it. A lot of the payments for some of these programs are scaled out so big. So the payments per acre are actually really low. So what's the, how do you incentivize somebody who's doing, say, 3 acres or 2 acres of, you know, market garden crop, who's contributing to the local economy? How do you incentivize them to go and access, you know, something for like subsurface drip or some sort of other aspect of an EQIP program when the payments are really low? I think if there was a MicroEquip where paperwork was kind of streamlined, and we could kind of trial out some of these programs to see if they could be scaled differently or the payments could kind of be different. I think that'd be really great.
Right. All of these programs and why the micro lending program was necessary, all of the paperwork is pretty intense. I mean, it's a lot because it's written and designed for oftentimes a much larger system, a much larger farm, a much more scaled farm than what the projects that beginning farmers are bringing to the table. Like that's why we just need to have, you know, different, a more flexible system that can make it easy for agents to say, of course, yeah, let's work with you. I have this program that was designed for this case.
Yeah, exactly. And like, that's the thing I will say, I'll give a shout out to Jolie, our NRCS agent over there in Cortez. This program wasn't coming out of him not being able to do anything or that office not being able to do anything. It's more that with the hiring freezes and everything going on, these offices are stretched so thin that part of the idea of MicroEquip is obviously incentivize young beginning and small acreage growers, but we need to, like you're saying, we need to incentivize the agents. They do so much work, and there's just so much paperwork and bureaucracy to be able to access these things. So if this program can alleviate even a little bit of that, I think they'd be much more amenable and available to work with young, small, and beginning producers.
So the idea for this started with you and Alex having beers at Convergence. And then what was the next step?
Well, it's funny, like when we had the idea, we weren't expecting it to go anywhere, to be quite honest. Like, you know, we were just like, we both thought it was a good idea. So then, like, you know, Kate Greenberg, who's Western Program Director, you know, I told her about it and she talked to people about it. I talked to Andrew in DC about it. And it just kind of kept on getting kicked around. It was like kick the can, to be quite honest. It was just kind of like, oh, this got mentioned here, got mentioned here, got mentioned to Bennett Staffer, it got mentioned to Tipton, it got mentioned blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I think it's serendipitous to a certain degree. I think we're lucky because there's all this awesome NYFC infrastructure. For some silly reason, I love policy. And we also, our state senator, Michael Bennett, is also on the Senate Ag Committee. So there's these little things that part of it's luck, part of it's hard work. Yeah, and I think eventually it just kind of got picked up. Like when all that went down, I was like, okay, this is crazy. So all of a sudden, you know, there's like a signed thing with Michael Bennett's signature being like, you know, this is going into the farm bill. And he's like saying my name on the Senate floor. And I'm like, okay. So at least, you know, my mom's proud now. So,
well, she should be.
So it was kind of good. I mean, the thing that, you know, if I want to communicate to, you know, those listening to the podcast, NYFC members or not, is that those crazy ideas, you know, those late night ideas, early morning ideas, like if you think it's a good idea, try kick it up the chain. Email your congressional staffer, you know, email your senator. Like if you think you have a good idea, like see if it can go up the chain.
A lot. I mean, the best ideas definitely come from real life experience in the field and interaction with federal programs. We need that as Young Farmers Coalition to know what ideas need to be, you know, moved up to Congress. And you know, frankly, not everything needs to be in the Farm Bill, right? A lot of the MicroEquip program, or excuse me, the microloan program was piloted by USDA, by Farm Service Agency, before it was put in the last Farm Bill. So there are things that can change, you know, just through a conversation with folks at USDA. We can make a lot of change by, just as you said, like thinking about how this might be different or how it might be better, and with the knowledge that indeed we can be quite powerful in this and really help to make those changes become reality.
Yeah. And I think another big thing for me, Lindsay, is like thinking about changes in programs and adjustments that aren't super major, but benefit, you know, your neighbors too, or even just benefit your neighbors. Because what I've realized around here, if my neighbors are happy and healthy, that has a direct effect on what's going on with me. It's like I hopefully will access my GreeQuip. You know, it's my plan, but if I don't, that's okay. I just hope a whole bunch of other people that it benefits them.
Well, we're going to be fighting for it in the House version of the Farm Bill and the final conference version. Of course, if, you know, we don't have a Farm Bill this year, we will look, you know, to administrative changes. Or if it's not put in the Farm Bill this year, I mean, that won't be the end of it. So thank you so much for your leadership with your chapter, with Four Corners. And thanks for speaking to me today. And man, I really hope that you guys have a good fall, because I know you need it. I hope you're going to be farming in 2019.
Well, I appreciate you giving me the opportunity.
All right, Mike, thanks so much.
Bye.
Next week, the Farm Bill is back. Andrew is going to tell us all about what's going on in conference committee as they try to get a Farm Bill done by the end of this month. Thank you to Mike Nolan for being on today's show. This show can be found wherever you get your podcasts. If you like us, please take a second to both rate and review us on iTunes and tell somebody else about what you learned on the show today. Thanks to Radio Kingston. Thanks to the National Young Farmers Coalition, the whole team there, Hannah Beal for editing, and to you for listening. Thanks so much.